Welcome to Lecture 21, Exploding Stars, Celestial Fireworks. Last time, I described the evolution of a typical star like our Sun. Our Sun has one solar mass. It burns hydrogen in its core, eventually becomes a red giant, finally becomes a white dwarf. The details are fairly hairy, but just get the general picture of what's going on. Final end state, a white dwarf, and the speed with which it approaches its final end state is dictated by the initial mass of the star. At least for single stars, the initial mass of the star is the dominant factor that dictates its evolutionary time scale. Now, the story I described would equally well apply to stars from about 8% of the Sun's mass up to about 8 solar masses. So it describes the majority of all stars, the majority of all single stars. But stars are sometimes binary, and as I indicated last time, when one star becomes a red giant, it can transfer material to the other star through this Roche lobe thing where they connect up. So it expands, and finally it becomes big enough that it actually transfers material to the other star. And that can increase the rate of evolution of the star that received mass from its donor, because it increases in mass, the pressures are higher, and it starts behaving like a more massive star. Eventually, that star that became the red giant becomes a white dwarf. The other star then expands and can transfer matter to the white dwarf. And you might get an accretion disk like the one shown here, where material spirals in a disk-like shape towards the white dwarf. You get a disk rather than material going straight to the star because the whole system is revolving. The two stars are orbiting each other, or their common center of mass, and it turns out that material has to go into a disk-like structure. Well, as material accumulates in the disk or accumulates on the surface of the star, one of several different instabilities can occur. The most powerful one is a nuclear instability, where, as you can see in this next image, the star's surface undergoes a nuclear runaway. A chain reaction occurs in the hydrogen and the helium, producing a great brightening, a great sudden brightening of the star, and that's called a nova. You can have a nuclear runaway at the surface, just the surface layers undergo this runaway, or in some cases you can have material sort of falling onto the surface of the white dwarf quite suddenly from the accretion disk. That also leads to a blast, but not as luminous, not as powerful a blast. The more powerful blasts are the nuclear runaways. Nevertheless, this does not disintegrate the whole star. It just represents the ejection of the outer sections of the star, the outer layers. And here is a picture from the Hubble Space Telescope of the aftermath of such an event, a nova that went off in 1992 in the constellation Cygnus the Swan, imaged, I think, probably around 1993 or 4, actually 1993, before the Hubble Space Telescope was fixed, before December of 1993. And then this picture was probably made in 1995, after the telescope was fixed. But you can see that between 1993 and 1995, this material has expanded out. In this particular case, probably the star was rotating, and the material really looks like it had a ring-like structure and not a spherical structure. The detailed analysis of that thing suggests that it really is kind of ring-like. But in any case, it's expanding out. Some heavy elements were synthesized by the explosion, but it was just a surface explosion. The star, you can see, remained intact. There it is. It's still there. The star survived. It's just its outer layers that went through this nuclear runaway. So that's called a nova, a reasonably dramatic brightening of the star. It brightens over the course of a few days to a few weeks, and then mostly usually a few days, and then declines over the course of weeks, months, and sometimes years. But the star basically remains intact. There's still a white dwarf there. There are, however, some completely catastrophic explosions of stars, where they completely obliterate themselves or leave just a very dense, small remnant behind. Here is a picture of one of these cataclysmic explosions, a supernova, a super new star. It's not a new star at all, of course. It's an old star going through its last gasp. It's just erupting because it's unstable. And I will describe those instabilities in today's lecture. They're very important for a number of reasons. First, they're fun to watch. You know, who among us doesn't enjoy a good 4th of July fireworks show? And this is the most powerful one imaginable, all right? Viewed from a safe distance, these supernovae, these exploding stars, can be fun to watch. They, they're really powerful, so they sometimes, as you can see here, look like about as bright as the entire galaxy in which they occurred. Here's the galaxy, and here's the supernova that went off in it, you know. Here's another supernova that looks almost as bright as the entire galaxy. Here's one that's a bit fainter, and here's one in a pretty galaxy. So they're very bright, and they brighten for a few weeks, and they fade over the course of months or years, and they're dramatic to watch. That's the first thing. But they have many effects on the universe. First of all, some of these exploding stars give rise, as I mentioned, to very compact remnants. In one case, this is called a neutron star. It's a ball of neutrons, maybe 10 or 15 kilometers in radius, and it's got the mass of the sun, or even a little bit more than the mass of the sun, compressed into a volume roughly the size of a city, all right, 10 or 15 kilometer radius. That's matter at nuclear densities. It's compressed to like one gigantic nucleus. A tablespoonful of this stuff would weigh about a billion tons, all right, as opposed to a white dwarf where a tablespoon weighs only about one ton or a few tons. So this is really amazing stuff. This allows us to extend our tests of the laws of physics to regimes that are not reproducible here in laboratories on Earth, because we cannot make any macroscopic quantities of such dense stuff. These are like gigantic nuclei. And in some cases, explosions give rise to an even more bizarre creature, the black hole. And I'll discuss black holes in about two lectures. Those are really weird, where gravity is so strong that nothing, not even light, can escape. Another thing that exploding stars do is to compress the gas between the stars. They send shock waves through the stars, or through the gas between the stars. And that can compress the gas and heat it up to great temperatures, tens of millions of degrees. And this gas can go flowing out of galaxies in vast galactic fountains. Some galaxies essentially rid themselves of much of their interstellar gas through these cosmic explosions, which sort of sweep away everything. So this can affect the appearance and the behavior of gas in galaxies. Moreover, some of these compression waves can trigger the gravitational instability that starts star formation. You know, you have a big cloud like a nebula. It's just about to gravitationally go unstable. It sort of wants to form stars, but it's not quite compact enough to form stars. Well, if a wave goes through and compresses it, that can trigger gravitational contraction, which leads to the formation of new stars. So the death of one star can trigger the formation of other stars, a cluster of stars in a nebula. These things also produce very high energy charged particles called cosmic rays, and they go traveling through the universe. They can interact with living cells, at least those that make it through Earth's magnetic field can interact, and that causes mutations. So some of the evolution on Earth is dictated by mutations caused by the cosmic rays from exploding stars. They're also extremely luminous. They're extremely powerful, so they can be seen at vast distances. You can see these things billions of light years away. And we will see later that this allows us to measure the distances of extremely distant galaxies, because we can see the exploding stars in them, and we can calibrate how intrinsically powerful nearby exploding stars are. And by comparing the nearby ones with the distant ones and comparing their brightness, we use the inverse square law to deduce the distance of the star and hence the galaxy that produced it. This is just the same way we determine the distances of oncoming cars at night. They appear faint when they're far away, and we know how bright they are when they're nearby, so we can determine the distance. So Supernovae allow us to do this branch of astronomy called cosmology, measuring the distances of very distant galaxies and using them as tracers of what the whole universe has been doing over the course of its history. That's something I'm particularly interested in, and in part 5 of this series, I'll be discussing cosmology and how supernovae are used to determine things about the universe. But from the human perspective, probably the most important aspect of the explosions of stars is that they produce many heavy elements and disperse them into the cosmos. They cook up heavy elements during the explosions. Things heavier than iron and things like iron are cooked up during the explosions and spewed out into the cosmos, making these elements available as raw material for the formation of new stars and planets. We have good reason to believe that the universe began only with hydrogen and helium. The rest of the elements got cooked inside stars. Now, we saw in the last lecture that carbon and oxygen gets produced in stars like our sun. But if all stars remained as white dwarfs at the ends of their lives and never exploded, then all that carbon and oxygen, or at least most of it, would remain forever hidden from view. It would just be in a white dwarf. It would not be available as raw material for the formation of new stars. You got to somehow get that stuff out into the cosmos so that it can become available to produce new stars and Earth-like planets. So in a series of slides here, I illustrate this phenomenon. Here's an exploding star. It conveniently has an arrow pointing at it. That's how you know it's going to explode. Not really, of course, but there it is. It explodes. And then over hundreds of years, the ejecta expand out. These are chemically enriched gases. They have calcium and oxygen and iron and carbon, things that we need for life. And over thousands of years, the gases spread out like this, gradually mix with other chemically enriched gases, form nebulae such as this one, and then those nebulae start gravitationally contracting, perhaps because of the influence of some nearby supernova, or perhaps on their own. They just become massive enough to start contracting. And in the central regions of those nebulae, new stars form. And those stars are chemically enriched in heavy elements. The calcium in our bones, the oxygen that we breathe, the carbon in our cells, the iron in our red blood cells. All those things were produced by or dispersed by the explosions of stars. Not to speak of the gold and silver in your jewelry. Those really heavy elements were produced by these explosions as well. So we think that these explosions are absolutely critical for the formation of planets like Earth, rocky, Earth-like planets, not gaseous or liquid hydrogen and helium-rich giants like Jupiter. Those sorts of planets could have formed early in the cosmos. Earth could not have formed early in the history of the cosmos because the proper elements did not yet exist. The biggest lesson we can learn from the explosions of stars is that our elements, the elements in our body, came from some of them. And I will show you the evidence for this in the next two lectures, that we are, as Carl Sagan used to like to say, we are made of star stuff. We are made of cosmic dust. That is the main message of these cosmic explosions. Well, the idea of how all the elements are synthesized by stars and these explosions was documented in a monumental paper by Margaret Burbidge, Jeff Burbidge, Willie Fowler, and Fred Hoyle. They were the first to, in some detail, show how these elements are formed by massive stars and their explosions. So let me discuss, then, massive stars and their explosions in this lecture. Stars explode only very rarely. In a galaxy such as this one, which has perhaps 100 billion stars, maybe only one or two will explode in a given century. So, not very common. You know, if I were a mean thesis advisor, I'd have each of my students looking at only one galaxy, and they'd get their PhD when they discover a supernova in that galaxy. They'd have to typically wait 50 years or more to find one. You've got to look at lots of galaxies to have a good chance of finding an exploding star. So you go around looking at lots of galaxies. It's like two-headed snakes. You know, they're rare, they exist, but you're unlikely to find one in your backyard. Okay, got to look in a lot of backyards. So we look at a lot of galaxies to try to find an exploding star in some of them. So you go and looking around, and you take photographs and things, and if you're lucky, you see something like this. All right, there's a galaxy before the supernova, and there it is afterwards. We just go around looking at the sky, trying to find arrows, okay? And those arrows are where the supernovae are. Well, I wish it were that easy, okay? It's not quite that easy. The arrows, of course, aren't there. You have to make the arrows. You have to distinguish this star, recognize it, see that it wasn't there in the past. And this one was pretty bright. This was one of the brightest ones in decades. Usually they're a lot dimmer and harder to distinguish. Now, a number of amateur astronomers have made very valuable contributions in this area. They look at galaxies such as this one here and its companion to the left, and they have, in some cases, memorized the pattern of stars around that galaxy. Now, these stars that you see individually here are foreground stars in our own Milky Way galaxy. They have nothing to do with this distant galaxy. They're just contaminant stars along the way. But if you view through your telescope this galaxy, and then on some other night, you see the same view, except there's an extra star somewhere, say right there, then that would be a supernova candidate. Okay? Now, the easy way to do this is to photograph the galaxies and then compare the two photographs. But there's a number of people who are memorizing what these galaxies look like. And the champion of these is Reverend Robert Evans in Australia, who has memorized the pattern of stars in our own galaxy around about 1,000 external galaxies. And he hops from one to the other, and he compares the new view with the old view and decides whether there's anything new in that galaxy. And usually there isn't. But he has found several dozen exploding stars by using this photographic memory of his. It's astonishing what he does. We do it the more easy way. We take before and after pictures of galaxies like the one I just showed. This is the same galaxy. In the inner region here, you can actually see a faint star that exploded. This wasn't a very bright supernova. But there it is afterwards, and there it is before. Again, conveniently marked with little arrows. We do this with a telescope that we've built at Lick Observatory in California near San Jose. It's a little telescope that just robotically goes from galaxy to galaxy hundreds of times per night. It can do 500 galaxies in a night. Just goes whipping around from one to the other, takes a picture. The software automatically compares the new picture with an old picture of the galaxy when we knew that there wasn't any supernova in it. And it sees whether there's anything new. It just subtracts the old one from the new one to see if anything new has come up. And usually there isn't anything new. But if you survey 500 galaxies per night, and you do that over the course of a week, and you're looking at, say, thousands of galaxies, then you have a reasonable chance of finding several in a year. And this is what we do. We look for these exploding stars. Here's the telescope. It's pretty small. The mirror is only 30 inches in diameter. But that's okay, because it's good enough to get a very nice picture of a galaxy in just 20 or 30 seconds. And so we can do hundreds in a night. And this was the first supernova that we discovered with this new system. It's called Supernova 1997 BS. Now, the lettering is not supposed to reflect the integrity of this supernova. It's a real supernova. The BS stands for the 71st supernova discovered in 1997. You start out with 1997, A, B, C, D, all the way up to Z. Then you go to AA, AB, all the way up to AZ, and then BA, and so on. So this happened to be the 71st, or BS, supernova of that year. All right, but it was our first one with this new system. Here's one that we discovered with a prototype system in 1994. You can see the power of a supernova. Here it is, one star in this galaxy. Look at that. This is a galaxy of about 100 billion stars, or maybe, 50 to 100 billion. And this one star is a reasonable fraction of the brightness of the entire galaxy. It's about a tenth or so, if you make the measurement properly. So this is like 10 billion normal suns, 10 billion times as powerful as a normal star. Another way to see that is that here's a star along the same line of sight, but it's in our own galaxy. And it's perhaps 600 light years away. Has nothing to do with this galaxy. This galaxy is 60 million light years away. So here's a single star, 60 million light years away, and it outshines a normal star only 600 light years away. The difference, the factor in luminosity is about 10 billion. This is about as luminous as 10 billion normal stars. These are truly colossal explosions, really colossal. You don't want to be near one of these things, okay? Well, when you take spectra, brightness versus wavelength of a bunch of supernovae, here's what you find. They come basically in two classes, called in a boring way by astronomers, type 1 and type 2. You'd think we might call them Fred and Gene or something like that, but no, we call them type 1 and type 2. Type 1 have all sorts of elements, calcium and oxygen and silicon and sulfur, iron, magnesium, calcium, you know, these are all things that were synthesized by the explosion or prior to the explosion. But they don't have hydrogen. Now that's strange because most stars in the universe have hydrogen. Most objects in the universe have hydrogen. Hydrogen is the most common element in the universe by far. But these don't have hydrogen. The type 2s do have hydrogen. This peak right here is due to hydrogen, all right? And there are some weirdos that don't quite fall in this classification scheme. We think that the type 1s have one explosion mechanism and the type 2s have another. A number of years ago, over a decade ago, actually, my former thesis advisor and I identified a type of star that kind of looked like a type 1, but it had more of the explosion mechanism of a type 2, and I'll explain that in a minute. But it didn't have any hydrogen, and we think that that star was stripped of its outer layer of hydrogen prior to the explosion due to maybe transfer of material onto a companion star, or perhaps the star had a hefty wind that blew the hydrogen away. We're not sure. There are a number of ways it can happen. But we talked about this discovery with some reporters, and I guess they decided to call it a strip-teasing star. So they said, astronomers peek at strip-teasing star. Those of you who know about these things know that you, as a scientist, have no control over what headlines actually appear in the end. All right, well, the type 1s, the ones without hydrogen, appear in all kinds of galaxies, and in particular, they appear in these kinds of galaxies that I'll discuss later, called elliptical galaxies. Elliptical galaxies have only old, low-mass stars remaining in them. All or almost all of the high-mass stars have all died away, all right? So only low-mass stars remain. So we think that the type 1s have something to do with low-mass stars. Moreover, the type 1s don't have hydrogen. So that suggests that maybe they have something to do with white dwarfs, because white dwarfs are often made out of carbon and oxygen and maybe some helium, but they have lost all their hydrogen. And finally, all the type 1s, or almost all of them, have about the same properties. You've seen one, you've seen them all. And that kind of sounds like it might be a white dwarf that has reached a limiting mass for its stability and has simply gone berserk. It's gone unstable, and this happens at the same mass in all cases. Well, those are all clues, and we've developed a model for this sort of thing. Not I, people did this before me, but by we, I mean the collective we. The model looks kind of like that we showed for a nova. You have a white dwarf and a star transferring material to the white dwarf. Now, the nature of the companion star is not yet well known. It might be a red giant. It might be another white dwarf that gets too close and gets torn apart. But in any case, this white dwarf here gains mass. And somehow it's able to bypass the usual nova mechanism where its outer layers go shooting off. Suppose it bypasses that mechanism. It's got to bypass it for us to get to the supernova stage because the nova mechanism tends to shoot off those outer layers of gas and the white dwarf's mass doesn't grow. You know, it gets material from its companion, but then the nova mechanism shoots all that stuff off, so the white dwarf's mass doesn't grow. However, in some cases, the white dwarf might bypass the nova mechanism and the mass might grow. If that's the case, the mass could conceivably reach the limiting Chandrasekhar mass of about 1.5 times the mass of our sun, about 1.4 solar masses. And at that point, the white dwarf becomes unstable. It's a small white dwarf at that point. Massive white dwarfs are small. And it's so crunched together that the nuclei hit each other with great vigor. The carbon and oxygen nuclei hit each other. They fuse, releasing nuclear energy. And that energy then makes the remaining nuclei hit each other even faster. They then fuse, and the whole thing goes off like a gigantic powder keg. But instead of being a chemical explosion, it is a nuclear explosion. It's a nuclear runaway. It's unlike our sun, which is a stable, controlled nuclear reactor. This is an uncontrolled runaway, and it occurs because the material is degenerate, and it does not have a chance to respond to increases in temperature and pressure the way our sun would respond by sort of breathing in and out and adjusting its size to a new equilibrium value. These things do not reach an equilibrium. When they reach an instability limit like that, they go pow, you know, and they just completely destroy themselves. All of the carbon and oxygen, all the other elements fuse together to form mostly iron type elements. Nickel in particular. Nickel tends to form a lot. And that nickel is radioactive, and it causes the embers of this supernova to glow for a long time, for months or even years. It sort of fades from view over the course of a few years, all right? But the end result is that you get a massive explosion. It gets brighter and then fades more slowly. And the brightening and fading depend on what filter you're using to examine the star. At infrared filters, there's sort of a double hump like that. It brightens, fades, then brightens again, then fades again. At red filters, or through red wavelengths, through red filters, it brightens, then sort of fades, then stays constant for a little while, then it fades again. At visual and blue and ultraviolet wavelengths, which you get by observing the star through those filters, it brightens and then just progressively fades. And the brightening takes maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and the fading takes months and even years. So by studying these so-called light curves of supernovae, we've come to model these things at these exploding white dwarfs. These kind of data are easily explained by an exploding white dwarf. The aftermath of the explosion looks something like this. You have an expanding, chemically enriched shell of material. It is like a bubble. And nothing is left on the inside. The star has completely obliterated itself. There is truly nothing left. It just went kapow, and that's it. The whole 1.4 solar masses burned up almost instantly in the thermonuclear runaway. So this is like nature's gigantic fusion bomb. All right, that's what it is. Heavy elements, however, are built up during this fusion. And as long as we aren't too near one of these things, the end result is good, because it pollutes the cosmos with these heavy elements, which can then be incorporated into stars and planets and presumably produce life like our own. So that's a type 1. It's thought to be an exploding white dwarf. Here is Sirius and its companion. Here's Sirius, the bright one, and its companion. The companion is a white dwarf. Sirius is only 8.7 light years away. Should we be worried? Okay, you know, if a supernova goes off 8.7 light years away, we should be worried. That's quite nearby. Fortunately, we do not think that the companion of Sirius, the little white dwarf down there, is anywhere near the explosive stage. It has a mass of something like 1.05 solar masses. Pretty far from 1.4, and it does not appear to be gaining mass from the big bright Sirius A. So Sirius B probably will not become a supernova, certainly not anytime soon if our calculations are right. And if we're not right, don't sue us, okay? Just leave us alone. Leave us to our misery, because we'll all be miserable if it goes off, okay? It'll be serious business, no pun intended, of course. All right, well, now let's look at the type 2s. They have hydrogen. What are they due to? Well, they are thought to be due to massive, giant stars. Type 2s appear in the spiral arms of galaxies. And the spiral arms are where massive stars are born. They also happen to be where massive stars die. That's because massive stars, like 10 to 15 times the mass of our sun, that's the kind of mass I'm talking about, they don't live very long. A 15 solar mass star only lives 10 million years, 1,000 times less than our own sun. And so they don't move away from their home very far in those 10 million years. The stars don't move through galaxies all that fast. So massive stars never have a chance to leave their homes. So if massive stars are born in spiral arms, we expect massive stars to die in spiral arms. And indeed, we see type 2 supernovae in spiral galaxies predominantly near or in the spiral arms. So we think they're big, huge stars. They are supergiants, okay? They're very luminous, evolved stars. They started out with 10, 20, 30 times the mass of our sun, and they are now in a very bloated stage. They are perhaps as big as Betelgeuse in the shoulder of Orion. Betelgeuse is a red supergiant. It's an especially big one. Look at, here's the size of Betelgeuse compared with the size of Earth's orbit. And here's the size of Jupiter's orbit. These are huge stars, okay? Their internal structure looks something like this. Near the ends of their lives, they look like an onion with layers of progressively heavier elements, hydrogen, helium, carbon, oxygen, shells of heavier elements, silicon and sulfur, things like that, all the way down to iron, iron in the core. Now, what has happened is that a massive star has sufficiently high temperatures and pressures in its deep interior to fuse heavy elements into still heavier ones. Now, our sun will fuse, it is fusing, hydrogen into helium. It will later fuse helium into carbon and oxygen. It'll stop at that point. But a more massive star can fuse carbon and oxygen into things like neon and magnesium, and then on to silicon and sulfur, and all the way up to iron, because it has enough pressure and temperature to jam these nuclei into each other, causing them to fuse. The ashes of one set of nuclear reactions becomes the fuel for the next set. Hydrogen to helium, helium to carbon and oxygen, on to magnesium, neon, silicon and sulfur, and iron. Each stage releases energy. Not much energy in those upper stages because you just don't release very much when you fuse silicon and things like that all the way up to iron, because the nuclei are just about as tightly bound as they can get, and so you don't release all that much energy, but you release some. Now, the iron sits here, and it will not fuse to produce still heavier elements, and that's because the star would not do itself any good by fusing iron into heavier elements. That would rob the star of energy. It would not create energy, because fusion of iron into heavier things requires energy. It does not give out energy. Hydrogen to helium gave out energy, lots of energy per reaction. Helium to carbon and oxygen gives out energy. It liberates energy. But iron is so tightly bound, the most tightly bound of the common nuclei, that fusion of iron into heavier things absorbs energy. It doesn't release energy. So the star would be doing itself in if it were to fuse iron. So what happens? Can it live forever in this state? No, because surrounding the iron is a layer of somewhat lighter elements that are vigorously fusing into iron. So the iron core increases in mass until it reaches an unstable limit of around 1.4 solar masses, very much like the Chandrasekhar limit that we discussed for a white dwarf. It becomes unstable. It says, look, I cannot hold up this giant massive star above me. Quit doing this to me. I give up. Atlas shrugged. He gave up. What happens to the star is that the protons and electrons combine to form neutrons and our old friend, the neutrinos. Now, the neutrinos go zooming out of the star. They hardly interact with anything at all. The neutrons remain. The neutrinos go zipping out. The neutrons remain. They are compressed to a ball roughly the size of a city. So this is about 1.5 times the mass of our sun, 1.4 times the mass of our sun, compressed into a tiny ball. You might say, okay, this sounds good, but it doesn't sound like an explosion. It sounds like an implosion. Where's the explosion which I promised you? Well, when the neutron star forms, when the core collapses, it doesn't just reach an equilibrium state right away. It bounces back a little bit. Like when you jump on a trampoline, you bounce upwards, and then you go back down, and you oscillate around a couple of times, and finally you reach equilibrium. Okay? But you bounce up for a little while. So when the core is rebounding against itself, like me off the trampoline, it encounters the infalling material, hits it, and ejects it. And it also gets some help from the neutrinos, because there's a flood of neutrinos coming out, and even though neutrinos don't generally interact very much, if there's enough neutrinos and there's enough material, some of them will interact, and they help push the whole thing out too. And that causes an explosion. Kaboom! Bang! As it says on the slide there. All right. I have a little demo here to illustrate this. I've got my little official NBA basket small, and by dropping it off the floor, I am simulating the rebound of the neutron star off of itself. So it collapses and then it rebounds. All right. The tennis ball will be the material over the core, which also collapses. Having had its pressure support removed, there's nothing holding it up. It's as though someone removed the floor from underneath me, and it will fall. Neither of these two balls bounces very high all alone like this. But if I start from a given level, all right, here's the height to which the basketball rises, and here's the height to which the tennis ball rises. If I now put the tennis ball, which is the material over the neutron star, on top of the basketball, look what happens. It goes way up because part of the energy of the rebounding core was transferred to the surrounding material. And that propels the material up. Now, in the case of the demo here on Earth, of course, Earth's gravity pulled it back down. I didn't have the ball escape completely. But you saw that it went much higher than it normally would if not given a super bounce like this. Moreover, as I mentioned, there are neutrinos in the picture as well, a whole flood of neutrinos. We will see in the next lecture just how many. And if even a percent of those neutrinos interact with the material that's on its way down, that will help propel the material out. So you do, in fact, get a successful explosion, even though here on Earth I can't quite simulate that because I can't get this thing to go at the escape velocity. Anyway, this idea of core collapse followed by a rebound was thought up by the brilliant but rather abrasive and arrogant astronomer Fritz Zwicky at Caltech in 1934. He and his colleague Walter Bade, shortly after the discovery of the neutron by Chadwick, postulated that massive stars have cores that collapse in this way at the ends of their lives, and that this mechanism produces an explosion, leaves behind a ball of neutrons, a neutron star, and their third prediction was that the explosion also produces a lot of cosmic rays, a lot of high-energy charged particles. They didn't think very much about the nucleosynthesis at that time, the synthesizing of heavy elements out of lighter ones. But here he is, probably showing some of his dimmer Caltech colleagues what would happen if the core of a star collapsed to the density of a neutron star, the mass per unit volume of a neutron star. He, you know, he was a fairly abrasive fellow, and he wasn't well-liked, but he was completely brilliant, and he's one of my idols because of all the great ideas he had. Anyway, here he is showing them what would happen. A more modern-day version is given here, where David Arnett, formerly of the University of Chicago and now at Arizona, is showing what the Sears Tower in Chicago would look like if compressed to the density, the mass per unit volume of a neutron star. it would be the size of the little gumball that he's holding. Now, you'd want to evacuate the people out of the Sears Tower before conducting such an experiment. Not that it could be conducted here on Earth. But that whole Sears Tower, if compressed to the density of a neutron star, would be about the size of a little tiny ball like that. So a neutron star consists of very weird material. It's like a gigantic atomic nucleus. And that is the residue of one of these core collapse or type 2 supernovae. That's what we think is happening. It's collapsing, rebounding, a flood of neutrinos comes out. And during this time, then, of the rebound, a lot of complex interactions take place. Here's a picture, a computer simulation of what might happen as gas from the central region goes flowing out as it's pushed away by this rebound and by the neutrinos. It develops all sorts of weird instabilities and stuff. It actually kind of looks like a nuclear explosion, like some of the bombs you get going off in the atmosphere. But in these tongues of gas rushing outwards, you have a lot of neutrons floating around, a lot of nuclei, and there's plenty of opportunity for the neutrons and the nuclei to come together quite rapidly. Neutrons get absorbed, bam, 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 into already heavy nuclei and produce still heavier ones. So nucleosynthesis of very heavy elements can occur during this explosion. That nucleosynthesis doesn't liberate energy. It doesn't help keep the star up. But that's okay. The star has given up trying to support itself in the normal way. It has exploded. There's lots of energy around, lots of ways in which neutrons can hit nuclei, build up their mass, and produce the heaviest elements. So this is where the heavy elements come from these sorts of explosions. Some of the heavy elements are produced in red giants through the slow capture of neutrons, but that occurs when already heavy elements capture neutrons in the atmosphere of a red giant. To have gotten the seeds for those reactions, you needed to have the heavy elements to begin with, and they were produced by explosions like this. So one way or another, essentially all of the heavy elements, many of which are so necessary for life, calcium and iron and things like that, came directly or indirectly from these explosions. Now, we would like to test these theories with a nearby supernova, but Johannes Kepler was the last astronomer fortunate enough to have seen a bright nearby, relatively nearby, not too nearby, supernova in our own galaxy. He observed a supernova in the year 1604. The person with whom he worked, the person from whom he got all his data, Tycho Brahe, observed a supernova in the year 1572. There were two bright supernovae only 32 years apart back then. They were pretty lucky. In fact, Tycho and Kepler became fairly famous for their supernovae, the ones they studied before the invention of the telescope. We've been waiting about 400 years for a supernova to go off in our own galaxy, near enough for us to see easily. One went off about 300 years ago, but it was in a region of our galaxy that was quite obscured by interstellar gas and dust. We now see the radio remnant of that supernova. It's called the Cassiopeia A supernova remnant. It occurred in the late 17th century, and maybe one or two people saw it, but only just barely at optical wavelengths. And it certainly wasn't studied back then, even though the telescope had been invented. We can now study its aftermath. But we've been waiting essentially 400 years for one to go off in our own galaxy, near enough for us to study with the vast array of telescopes that span the entire electromagnetic spectrum. That's what we'd like to do. Our own galaxy has all this dusty gas in it. Surely a supernova has occurred in our own galaxy at least a few times since Kepler and Tycho's supernovae of 1572 and 1604. But we haven't seen those exploding stars because they've been hidden from view by all this gas and dust, all this material that's between us and the rest of the stars. We will see in part 4 of this class that we can only discern stars within a few thousand light years of us. Beyond that, most of them are hidden from view by all this interstellar gas and dust, the smog. Well, you know, we've just been unlucky. We haven't seen a good one nearby. But a great one occurred in 1987 in a satellite galaxy of our own, only 170,000 light years away. It occurred in a reasonably unobscured region, and we were able to view it with a wide array of telescopes. That supernova, 1987A, taught us a tremendous amount about the explosions of stars, verified much of what we thought we knew, and extended the range of our knowledge. It was a watershed in the study of supernovae, and I'll describe it next time.